If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to the History Extra podcast. Fascinating historical conversations from BBC History Magazine and BBC History Revealed. What can Viking poetry reveal about the era it was written in and the people who wrote it? And why are ships, love and death some of its most recurring themes? Judith Yeshk, Professor of Viking Studies at the University of Nottingham, and Caroline Larrington, Professor of Medieval European Literature at the University of Oxford, shared their expert insights with Matt Elton, tackling listener questions and reading excerpts from some of their favourite examples of Norse writing. The first voice you'll hear after Matt is Judith.
I wanted to start, first of all, with some very general context for people who might not know very much about this subject. When and where are we talking about when we talk about Viking poetry? When did it happen?
Yeah, well, there's two things. I mean, poetry in a Scandinavian language we have evidence for from about the 4th century onwards up until the present day. And it, in some ways, there is some continuity between that very earliest poetry and poetry going right up at least until the Reformation and often later. So when we're talking about Viking poetry, we're talking about two things. We're talking about a small amount of poetry that we can confidently say was actually composed and written in the Viking Age, which is mainly poetry in runic inscriptions. Then we're talking about poetry that we're fairly confident was composed in the Viking Age but wasn't written down until later when the Scandinavians learned the art of writing manuscripts. There we're talking about skaldic poetry. And the third thing we're talking about is a form of poetry known as Eddic poetry, which was only written down in after the Viking Age in the Middle Ages. But we think at least some of it has its origins in the Viking Age. And the Viking Age, you'll get different answers from different scholars, but I would normally give it a generous date range of about 750 to 1100. And then the manuscripts we're talking about are mainly from the 13th century and later.
Lovely. And we've asked listeners and visitors to our social media pages for questions on this subject. And as you can imagine, we've had a huge number of responses, actually, which is great. So I thought along the way, I could just throw in some of those to run past you both. The first one, I suppose, really is C.E. Healy 92 on Instagram wants to know, how wide do you think the audience for poetry was? And was poetry reserved for the elite or only some sections of society?
This is, I think, where we have to begin by distinguishing between the two types of poetry that Judith mentioned in the first instance. And scholars of Old Norse literature would say the division between skaldic poetry and Eddic poetry isn't quite as clear-cut as we might make it sound when we're talking about it today. But basically, skaldic poetry is complicated, intricate. It depends on rhyme, half-rhyme, assonance, alliteration, all kinds of riddling metaphors, and sometimes sentences that are broken up and stuck into the middle of other sentences. And in comparison, Eddic poetry is much more like the alliterative poetry that we have in Old English, and which goes through into Middle English as well. And that's a fairly simple alliterating four-beat line. And I think it's probably reasonable to guess that people could generally, almost everybody, could understand Eddic poetry, and many people could probably compose in it extempore. It's not really very difficult to produce Eddic verses. But skaldic poetry, and I'll hand over to Judith for this, is much more difficult.
It's not only difficult, but it's also one of the interesting distinctions on the whole between Eddic and skaldic poetry is that Eddic poetry is largely anonymous, and skaldic poetry is largely attributed to named poets, which I think suggests something about the different social status of those two kinds of poetry. And with anonymous poetry, there's always the question, are you just talking about one poet having composed that poem, or is the poem something that's gradually evolved, perhaps in an oral or even a scribal tradition?
So it sounds like these two forms are doing slightly different things for different audiences. Is that fair to say?
It's very hard because the Eddic poetry was written down so much later than the time at which we guess it was composed. It's quite hard to work out what kind of audience it could have been composed for. We have plenty of accounts in the sagas of named poets reciting their skaldic verse in front of rulers. But we don't really have accounts of people reciting Eddic poetry, except in certain kinds of sagas, which are largely fictional anyway. And so we can't be sure that the verses that are being recited in this particular context are at all historical, and they're not just being made up by the author because there's a prophetess, let's say, who needs to prophesy. She makes a prophecy and somebody responds in verse. Now, we don't really believe that that's a historical situation at all. It's entirely fictional, and probably the verse isn't very old. But it's the case still in Iceland today that people can absolutely extemporize verse in ballad meter, which is a fairly straightforward kind of meter. And I guess people in English can probably make up verse off the cuff in a very simple meter as well. And I suspect that they probably could with Eddic poetry. There was a point, I suppose, about 30 years ago, when the suggestion was made that perhaps women were particularly good at Eddic poetry because they didn't have to have any kind of specialist training to do it. And perhaps these anonymous voices were the voices of women, people who are excluded from the kinds of systems of patronage and preference that determine the skaldic poet's career.
Given the difficulties and the problems of tracing these sources and sort of the difference in time period, can we tell anything about the ways in which people who composed or performed poetry were regarded at the time?
Well, certainly in the case of skaldic poetry, the skalds themselves frequently... These are poems designed for public performance before the ruler and his court, and they will either be not so subtly hinting that they should be paid or indeed thanking the ruler for his generosity. There's endless references to the generous ruler, and from some of the saga accounts, that generosity, we're told, might consist of a whole ship, which would be, I think, a very expensive gift for a poem.
And we've also had a few questions about whether there were famous poets at the time.
It's hard to tell who was famous at the time, because the ones that survive, particularly to the modern day, may not have been the most famous at the time. And I think the one that everyone would think of most would be Egill Skallagrimsson, the 10th century Icelander, who has his own saga, which is chock full of his own poetry. So I don't know what Caroline thinks.
I would suggest Bragi, actually, Bragi the Old, who seems to be one of the earliest poets who is recorded as a named poet, and whose name perhaps coincidentally turns out to be the same as the god or one of the gods of poetry in some of the mythological writing. So it may be that he's somebody who was famous enough to become a god. He's not named as a god in the mythological poetry, but he certainly turns up in a 13th century treatise on mythological poetry. And that makes it sound perhaps as if he might be somebody who turned from a human poet into a kind of divinity. He is mentioned in one poem, but there he's not particularly, or somebody with his name is mentioned in one mythological poem, but there he's not associated with poetry particularly.
I wouldn't call him the Viking Chaucer. I don't think he's anything like Chaucer. He was, as far as we know, I mean, he lived around the year 800, or that's what scholars think anyway, and he was a Norwegian, which is interesting because the vast majority of our surviving poetry seems to have been composed by Icelanders.
I just want to pick up something we talked about then without sort of any reference to it. People becoming gods isn't something that necessarily happens these days. How might that have happened? What does that mean in this context?
I suppose what it means really is that the theories which were propounded in the Christian period to explain why people had believed in pagan gods in the first place there were two possible options. And the one was that the pagan gods were diabolical. They were a bunch of demons sent by Satan to mislead people. But the other very popular theory was that they were just extremely clever humans who, in effect, bamboozled their contemporaries through their superior knowledge of technology and magic and various skills into worshipping them. And so this is a process called euhemerism, after a Greek philosopher who thought of this particular process. And it saves quite a lot of time, really, if you can assume that the gods don't really exist. They're just very good at telling stories about themselves and impressing people. We might think of the way that Roman emperors got turned into gods and worshipped after their death.
And Bragi certainly was very clever because his poetry is fiendishly difficult. So I think he fits that model.
It would be good at this point, I think, to delve into some of the examples of the kind of things we're talking about. I wondered if there's any specific examples that you'd like to highlight or that you think are particularly interesting.
Well, I've brought along here a poem called Helga Kryther Hundingsbane in Fyri, or the first poem about a hero called Helgi, the slayer of Hunding. And I thought it might be nice just to read this one verse, stanza 27 in his poem, which describes sailing off on a battle expedition across the sea. And I thought I might read it in Old Norse first and then read a translation in English. So this is the sound of Helgi's expedition setting out on a fine day to go and kill some neighbours. Bad aura imer ok jarna glimir. Brast rund vid rund, rero vikingar, eisen di gek und earthlingum, lovthungs floti lundum fjarri. And what that is in English is, there was the splash of oars and the clash of iron. Shield smashed against shield, the Vikings rode on. Hurtling beneath the nobles went the leader's ship far from the land. So you can hear there, I think there's a little bit of rhyme in that, as well as quite a lot of alliteration and quite a lot of the sense of the ship moving very fast, hurtling across the water, and then the shields clanging together as the shields we imagine on the side of the long ship rattling as the ship gets up speed. But you can also hear that it's not very complicated. It mainly gets its effects from rhythm. And it's one of the best verse in the whole of Eddic poetry for describing what it was like being on one of those sea voyages.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
That's incredible. There's such a sense of atmosphere from that.
You really can imagine what it was like. In the next verse, a bit of a storm blows up. So then it all becomes rather alarming for the Vikings. But at that point, there's real self-confidence.
Well, it's funny. I have a very similar example, but from skaldic poetry. And it would be interesting to kind of compare these two because they are in a different meter. They use different literary techniques, yet the theme is very similar. Now, the poem that Caroline read, Helgi, the poem about Helgi Hundingsbani, we don't really know when it was composed. This one I'm going to read, we do know, we're fairly certain it was composed in the mid-11th century. There was a kind of flowering of poetry, particularly about sailing, by various Icelandic poets who were propagandists and historians for the kings of Norway. This is a time when the kingdoms were just developing. And it was also a time when ship technology was developing very quickly. And what we think of as a classic Viking ship, the kind of very long, narrow scathe, warship with possibly 70 or 80 men on board, that's the kind of ship we're talking about at this point. So this is by an Icelandic poet called Arnór Þórðarson, and it's about King Magnus the Good, the son of St. Olaf. He was a very young king. He died when he was 24, but this is an expedition he was making to Denmark in around 1042. And it just describes him sailing along the Norwegian coast. Ljótu dreifa lifting utan láðri bifðis gol it ráða. Fastligur hneigði fúru geistri fyris garm og skeiðar stýri. Styrðum helst stavangur norðan, stálum bifðusk fyrir alar, uppi glóðu elmars typpi, eldi glík í dana veldi. Skaldic poetry is notoriously difficult to translate, so here I'm going to rely on Diana Whaley's translation into prose. She's not attempting a poetic translation. Foul surf surged in against the after deck and the helm of the warship. The red gold shuddered. The powerful hound of the fir tree pitched the rushing ship of fir. You steered sturdy prows from the north past Stavanger to the realm of the Danes. Currents shuddered in front. The mastheads of the storm steed glowed aloft like fire. Now, there's several things you need to kind of be aware of when listening to that. First of all, there are a couple of kennings. We haven't mentioned kennings yet. We'll probably have to talk more about kennings. These are roundabout ways of referring to things. So the powerful hound of the fir tree, it's like a dog attacking a fir tree. It's a kenning for the wind. And you can imagine the mast of the ship like a tree and the wind shaking it as if it was a dog attacking it. And then the storm steed is a slightly unusual kenning for ship. But also, there are little details here which are really interesting. There's quite a lot of technical terminology about different parts of the ship. And this poetry is actually really useful information for how ships were built and sailed in the 11th century. And we're told twice about something glowing red gold or glowing like fire. And this is a king, after all. And we're told, whether it's true or not, I'm not entirely sure, but we're told that their ships were often decorated with gold. So they really kind of made an impact as they're sailing. And then there's also deep geographical detail here. He's sailing from the north past Stavanger in southwest Norway. He's heading towards Denmark. So this is the rudimentary historian here, recording the actual expedition of this king, where he's going, but also conjuring up a picture of what it's like to actually sail in one of these ships.
That was fascinating to hear both those examples. Thank you so much for doing that. It's interesting that you chose examples that depicted broadly similar thematic concerns. Is that a coincidence, or does that tell us something more generally about this?
I think it's probably a coincidence, because I chose my verse because it's the probably most people's most profound association with Vikings is that they hurtle across the ocean on ships. But actually, the vast majority of Eddic poetry is conversation between two different people, or sometimes there may be a monologue. So mine is a fairly atypical example. Most of the poems, the mythological poems, are very often conversations between one or more divine figures. Perhaps they're outlining wisdom, perhaps they're having an argument with other people in which they're being kind of mutually rude about each other. Or perhaps in one case, it's simply telling a story, but the story is told through dialogue between characters like Thor and Loki, so well known to us now from the Marvel universe, for example. And in the heroic poetry, quite often, not all of the action, but quite a lot of it is, again, conversations with people. I'm inviting you to my hall. Should I go to the hall? Do not go to the hall. It's a bad idea. No, I must go to the hall, because if not, I will look like a coward. You should not have come to the hall. They have come to the hall. Now we're going to attack them. So it slows down the action in some ways. But it means that when you have a moment of action, when the third person narrator steps in and tells you what the fighting looked like, then it makes quite a contrast between the kind of dialogue heavy bits of the rest of the poetry.
It was a coincidence, but it's also interesting to look at where they overlap. But most Skaldic poetry, the majority of the surviving poetry at any rate, is from this period between about 950 and 1100, when there's this flowering of praise poetry as the kings of Scandinavia are growing into their power. And the actual topics, there's only so many things you can praise a king for. You can praise him for being generous, you can praise him for winning battles, and you can praise him for being an effective sea captain. So the interest of the poetry is much more in the way it's done, and these complicated the complicated diction, the strict use of meter and alliteration and so on, and not so much in what they're actually saying. So I'm afraid that quite a lot of the Skaldic poetry is in fact about these very things: battles, sailing, and kings generally, and what they got up to. Although the genre is much broader than that, certainly, but that's the kind of quintessential Skaldic poetry when we think of it, where you have a named poet, you have a named ruler who is being praised either during his own lifetime, which is a bit tricky because you have to be careful what you say in the poem, or after his death, and then probably just as tricky because you're talking to his heirs and
you have to be careful. Or possibly his enemies.
Possibly his enemies.
Being responsible for him no longer being around. Yes,
exactly.
So politically very awkward moment, that transition, isn't it?
Yeah.
You mentioned kennings. Were there any other techniques that we should know about in these forms?
Well, there's different kinds of kennings for a start. Sometimes they are metaphorical. Sometimes they allude to mythology. And this is another area where there's overlap between Eddic and Skaldic poetry, because Eddic poetry tells us the myths. It tells us the stories that were recognized as myths. In Skaldic poetry, doesn't, most of it doesn't. There are some exceptions, but most of it doesn't actually tell the stories. But within the kennings, it alludes to those myths. So there's a huge body of mythological knowledge hidden away in Skaldic poetry. So there's metaphorical, there's mythological kennings. There's what's called true kennings, when Thor is called son of Odin. It's a roundabout way of referring to Thor, but it's true, unlike the metaphorical ones. And then there's another kind of diction that we call hati, which I suppose is a poetic synonym. So it's a synonym for something that tends only to occur in poetry and not in normal speech. So those are the main forms of poetic language. And you do have simple kennings in Eddic poetry as well as hati.
Yes, they tend not to run to three or four different kinds
or
of
seven.
Nouns, or seven indeed in the worst case scenario, in the most complex kerning known to man or beast. In Eddic poetry, you get something like because the one of the fundamental conceptual ideas in the formation of Old Norse poetic metaphor is that basically the people are trees. Humans were created from trees, from driftwood or from wood found on the seashore in one account. And so you can call a man an apple tree with arm rings, or an apple tree with a sword, or a maple of a sword again. And a woman can be an elm wearing linen, or an elm of jewellery. So those are very simple kind of two-part expressions. We also get a little bit in Eddic poetry the idea that battle is a kind of storm of the Valkyries, these mythological women who allot victory in battle following Odin's commands, or sometimes not following Odin's commands. And they ride in the sky over the battlefield and grant victory or cause defeat. And there are lists and lists of the names of these women. So the storm of Gundel can be a term for a battle, and Gundel there is a Valkyrie name.
So what you need to do there is you need to have that knowledge, because you need to know that Gundel is a Valkyrie in order to understand that Storm of Gundel refers to battle. And that's why Skaldic poetry in particular, but also much Eddic poetry, requires that kind of knowledge of people.
We've had a few questions in about thematic concerns and themes. Idle Vignette on Instagram asks, what type of imagery was most common and how did it tie to their culture and society? And Amanda Rarely Mandy asks, what themes of love and family did they explore?
Two rather different questions, I think.
I'm going to go for the love and family one, because I think that's easiest. They're not normally that keen on love and family. I think in the Eddic poetry, usually if there's a love, it's a doomed love. So very often you'll have a hero like Sigurd of Fafnisbani expressing falling in love with somebody, but he doesn't spout love poetry. So it's usually after the hero has been killed that we hear the women who love them mourning for them. When Sigurdr has been killed, murdered treacherously by her brothers, his wife Gudrun says that he towered above other princes as a stag towers above other animals, and that he rose out of the grass like a leek out of other grass. He was a precious stone. So you get some very striking imagery in Eddic poetry, but usually in the context of loss rather than celebration. Though in one poem where I'm afraid another woman has just been, in fact, a Valkyrie has just been awakened by Sigurdr from the enchanted sleep that Odin has put her into, there's a wonderful piece of verse in which she wakes up for the first time in, we might imagine, hundreds of years and greets the day and says, hail to the day, hail to the sun, hail to the gods, hail to the goddesses, hail to all the elves. And hail to the hands that have just awoken me, and may they always be blessed. And it's the one piece of Eddic verse which the composer Richard Wagner actually takes across into his opera, the opera Siegfried, in fact, the third in his cycle, Der Ring des Nibelungen. And it's the one piece of verse that translated into German he keeps intact. So there's some wonderful effects around passion, but not really much that we could describe as love poetry in the Eddic verse at all. And if family verse is very much more, I love this person, but now they're dead.
Well, can I just jump in there about love? Because as I said a moment ago, a lot of Skaldic poetry, it can sneak in interesting ways of looking at things in spite of being very, very formulaic and predictable. And one of my favorite poems brings together those two motifs of being in love and Viking ships. And I'd love to read it to you and then talk about it a little bit. It's an Icelandic poet called Hallfreðr Ottarsson, who lived in the kind of late 10th century mainly. And several of these poets are known to have had very unsuccessful love lives. but this is him on describing or explaining his love for his girlfriend. Þykki mér esek þekki þunn ísunga gunni sem flei brautir fljóti flei meðal tveggja eia. En þás ser a sagu söms í kvinna flámi sem skrátbúin skrýði skeið með gildum reyða. And I tried to translate this into a form of English that captures some of the technical aspects. So there's a certain amount of assonance and in here, and a little bit of alliteration as well, and the syllable counting of skaldic poetry. I thought when I caught sight of the gunn of fine linen that a boat was floating on the sea between two isles, and the seam saga gleamed amidst the stream of women like a well-equipped warship with sail and golden tackle. The guy is comparing his beloved to a ship.
But a really lovely, a really splendid ship, isn't it?
And you know, there's technical terminology. So first of all, she's a flay, which is a kind of ferry type ship floating on the flay roads. And then she ends up at the end of the stanza as a skeið, what I mentioned earlier, the big Viking warship of the 11th century with gilded tackle. She's a goddess of the seam. Now, there's a pun there because the seam refers to the seams, the way her clothing was sewn together. But it's the same word is used for the nails that are used to make a ship when you kind of put the planks together. So she's a goddess of both the ship and her clothing. Her headdress evokes the sail, and then she's floating between two isles. Now, the word a, which means island, is often used in kennings for women. So she's standing out amongst the group of women. She's the most beautiful, the most glorious of all women. And that's just, at one level, it's so trite. It's like, you know, a young man today can't quite decide whether he's more proud of his girlfriend or his car. and yet it's also very, very beautiful. It's obviously the two most important things to him brought together into one thing.
We should talk more about the thematic concerns, I suppose, and the subject matter. How do these kind of works deal with subjects of sort of death and mortality?
Well, everybody is interested in death in the Viking world because it's coming for you sooner than you might expect. And perhaps one of the most interesting complexes that goes across both skaldic and Eddic poetry is the idea of what happens to you when you die in battle. I've already mentioned the Valkyries, these women who ride above the battle and decide who is going to live and who's going to die. And it's absolutely vital to die in battle if you want to spend eternity in Valhalla, in Valhötl, as it is in Old Norse, with Odin, practicing your battle skills for when the day of Ragnarok comes, when the end of the world comes and the Jötnar, the giants, march against the gods and the cosmic monsters are unleashed. And the human heroes are going to come out of Valhurt to fight on the side of the gods. Unfortunately, unsuccessfully, as we know, because the bridge that carries them is going to collapse and they're all going to plunge probably into the sea or into some kind of molten lava. But although it sounds very glorious to go to Valhalla, we have some elegies for Norwegian kings who perish on the battlefield in which the kings are depicted as really quite disgruntled about having been taken off to Valhurt. And if we got time, I would quite like to read a little bit from a poem which is in an Eddic meter by the poet Eyvindr Skaldaspitler Finnsson. So this is a verse from a poem called Haakonarmál. It's about the death of King Haakon. It's composed by a poet called Eyvindr Skaldaspitler, which seems to mean something like plagiarizer or borrower from other poets, Eyvindr Finnsson. And in stanza 12, we have King Haakon talking to the Valkyrie in a not particularly pleasant frame of mind. Kvíðus frá gunni skiftir geirskögur, orum þú verðir gangs frá góðum. Vjörð fí völdum, es þú vetli helst, en þína fjándur flugu. And what the king says is rather bitterly is, why did you decide the battle thus? Spear Skirtle, that's the name of the Valkyrie, though we were worthy of victory from the gods. And Spear Skirtle, Geir Skirtle replies, we brought it about that you held the field and your enemy fled. Unfortunately, the king died in the process. And after that, the king still doesn't cheer up particularly in Valhöll. And he says he thinks that Odin has double-crossed him. And he's told he can put his weapons to one side. He won't need them at the victory feast. But he says that he feels it's not a good idea to step more than 1 foot away from your weapons in these circumstances. And then the poem wraps up with Eyvindr saying that the grey wolf, Fenrir, will be unleashed against the homes of men, that the end of the world will come before another so splendid king is born among men. So there's a wonderful sort of sense of impossibility. We shall never see his like again at the end of the poem. But I love the way in which nothing cheers Haakon up about the fact that he has ascended to this glorious hall.
Yeah, and just to show that Skaldic poetry isn't all about kind of battle-hardened warriors, I want to bring in another king, St. Olaf, that we mentioned earlier, who died in battle in the year 1030 in Norway. And there aren't any poems showing him going to Valhöll because he very quickly was venerated as a Christian saint, and he was a Christian already as a king. And my favorite poet is an Icelander called Sigvatr, who was very close to King Olafur. Very embarrassingly for the poet, because the poets were supposed to be there kind of recording events so that they could compose their poetry and tell people about it. He was in Rome at the time his king died on the battlefield. But he has several lovely stanzas about it. I'll just tell you about one of them, which I think has one of the most beautiful lines in Skaldic poetry. He's heard about the battle and the death of Olafur, and he's also heard that there was a solar eclipse on that day. So I won't read the poem to you, but I'll just say, read the translation. This is my own translation. People declare that no small wonder that the cloudless sun was not able to warm the gods of the steed of the prop. Those are warriors. Great was the portent concerning the king during that daytime. And here's my favorite line. The day did not achieve its beautiful color. I heard of the event at the battle from the east. Dagr naðit lit fögrum. So that just summarizes his feelings on the death of King Olafur. And then in another poem, he talks about how the sloping cliffs of Norway used to laugh when Olafur was king. And now that Olafur is dead, the slopes seem to me much less agreeable. Such is my affliction. So he's really emotional at having lost his king, even though we do know that he sometimes composed poetry for rival kings, but on hearing about the death of Olafur, he's very, very sad. And there's some very lovely poetry composed by him in this Skaldic style.
It must be fascinating and so rewarding working with these kind of sources.
It really is. Interesting for me in particular. I've always loved Eddic poetry because I love stories, and I have been fascinated since I was very young with the myths and the heroic legends of the North. And even though there are questions about when these poems were actually composed, they are the oldest written sources that we have for the great mythological tales that have come down to us. Now, they're not set down in a particularly systematic way in the poetry. They're very often episodic, or they're allusions to things that we don't know about. but they were the basis for the Prose Edda, which was a poetic and mythographic treatise by the Icelander Snorri Sturluson, who composed this material in around 1230 or so. And he drew on Skaldic poetry and Eddic poetry for his information about how poetry worked. And lots of the Skaldic poetry is actually preserved in Snorri's great mythological treatise and poetic treatise. But for the first part of the treatise, though, which explains the mythology you need to know to understand the Kennings, draws very much on Eddic verse. And quite a lot of one of the most important poems, the Ceres's Prophecy, which takes us from the very beginning of time, before the world was created, all the way through to Doomsday, a lot of that is preserved, not solely preserved, but a particular version of it is preserved in Snorri's writing. And so for me, the fascination is it's a way to get to what the people thought, what tales they told about the gods, and what tales they told about heroes, very often heroes from a Germanic past that predates the settlement of Iceland, that takes place in Central Europe rather than Scandinavia quite often, and which has heroes among the Huns and the Goths and the Burgundians, not about Scandinavians at all. So the material is very ancient, even if perhaps the poems might have been composed a bit later.
Yeah, my where I'm coming from is slightly different in that although I was trained in Old Norse language and literature, I've kind of gradually become more and more fascinated by the Viking Age itself and how we study it, particularly since the vast majority of our written sources were written down later. And I mentioned runic inscriptions earlier, and I just love runic inscriptions because, especially rune stones, because they are thousand-year-old monuments that are still very often in their original place that someone carved, and they're unique. So the words on these monuments were thought by the person who carved the monument. Whereas in manuscripts, the texts have often gone through several stages of scribal adaptation and so on. And there is at least one Viking Age monument with a complete Skaldic stanza on it. And so that makes the link for me. And then I've studied Skaldic poetry for many years. And there, although most of it, with this one exception, survives in later manuscripts, I think there are good arguments for at least some of that actually being also direct evidence for the Viking Age, precisely because of the difficulty that Caroline was alluding to earlier. You have basically stanzas of 8 lines of 6 syllables each, so 48 syllables. You have to have a very complex system of internal rhyme, both full and half rhyme. You have to have alliteration, and you ideally want to incorporate some of this special diction, this language we were talking about. So that's why a Skald was worth a whole ship if he could compose a really good poem. And to me, that style of poetry is actually designed for an oral culture which didn't yet have a way of recording events. They couldn't write things down except in runic inscriptions, but those don't work in quite the same way. But they wanted to remember, as Caroline was saying earlier, remember people after their death. So the poet's job was to embody this in this poetry. And then people, we're talking about audiences, we don't know, but we assume that people did actually listen. And because of the structure of the poetry, it's quite easy to remember correctly. Whereas Eddic poetry, you're more likely to remember the story, I think. And there might be changes in the actual text. So people remembered these. And then fairly soon afterwards, writing came along and they wrote these down. So I think there's a kind of link to the Viking Age that I've always been very fascinated by. I mean, it's complicated and you can't assume that every Skaldic poem is from the Viking Age, but it's lots of fun to try and work out whether it is or not.
And we could talk about this for hours. We only have a few more minutes, sadly. We've had quite a few questions, including from Julia Yoga on Instagram. What would be a good first read for people who are interested in finding out more about this subject?
Well, I would, of course, recommend my own translation of the Poetic Edda from Oxford World Classics, the second edition, which was published in 2014. And that, I think, is a useful introduction to Eddic poetry in terms of an introduction that explains quite a bit about it, and a translation of the most important mythological and heroic poems. It's not a poetic translation as such, but it does make an effort with alliteration and rhythm. And so that, I think, is quite a good starting place for actually reading the poetry. But Margaret Clunies Ross and Heather O'Donoghue have also written introductions to old Icelandic poetry, both of which are quite readable and accessible.
I think if you want to start even earlier, just to show I'm not single-minded, I produced a little book called Viking Poetry of Love and War some years ago. As published by British Museum Press, and it's got pictures as well as snippets of both Eddic and Skaldic poetry, including some of the ones that we've discussed today. And so that's possibly for the absolute beginner.
Well, that's been fascinating. Thank you both so much for your time and for hearing some of that original source material. It was amazing. Thank you so much. Before we go, is there anything else we've not talked about in terms of how people should see this material, or how it, you think, gives us an insight into the time it was composed?
I think one thing that's among the questions that I've just glanced at that the listeners have sent in is a question of how much poetry there is. And the answer to that is an enormous amount, and much more Skaldic poetry than Eddic poetry. But it's probably important to remember that, including prose as well, of course, old Icelandic literature is the largest medieval literature that survived after Old French, way more of it than there is of Middle English. And a lot of that, and a lot of the most interesting material, in our view, of course, is poetic. So I think there's huge amounts of it that if you really get the taste for it, you can work your way through finding out about.
I was quite intrigued by, there was a question, was poetry more important to the Vikings than other cultures? And that's a, of course, it's an impossible question, because how can you compare? But it did remind me, I think it's an important point that in the Viking Age, I think it's not just poetry. I think all aspects of rhetoric, verbal art, expressing yourself interestingly, was very highly valued. So poetry, the law in an oral culture required similar kinds of knowledge and memory. They loved riddles and jokes, and they all had crazy nicknames. There's something about the oral art is, and this is, I think, what eventually led to the sagas as well. So once they learnt the art of writing, they were so well versed in speaking and expressing themselves and doing things in an interesting way that the writing of sagas just came naturally to them.
And it's an art form, isn't it, of a culture that's on the move. You don't have to be sitting in the studio. You don't have to have a cathedral with walls that you want to paint. You don't have to have a loom or a woodworking yard. You can do it anywhere. You can do it as many of the poets claim to compose verses on the ship as it's making its way across the ocean to Iceland or on the edge of battle. And so that poetry takes in verses which are supposed to have been performed and composed in North America, in Greenland, in Byzantium, in the Mediterranean. It's a verse along the rivers of Russia. It's an artistic form that goes anywhere.
And that poet that we mentioned earlier, Egil Skallagrimsson, the Icelander, he's remembered in his saga for having composed his first verse at the age of 3. Now, it's impossibly complicated for a 3-year-old. There's another poem he composed when he was 6, which I can quite believe that he composed when he was 6. The 3-year-old poetry is not possible, but it just shows how how a really good poet was expected to be. This is what people valued, is the ability to compose poetry.
That That was Judith Yeshk and Caroline Larrington speaking to Matt Elton. Judith is the author of books, including Viking Poetry of Love and War, published by the British Museum Press. And Caroline's books include The Norse Myths, which was published in March by Thames and Hudson. Caroline's 2014 translation of the Viking Edda is published by OUP. And you can explore more Viking poetry for yourself by visiting skaldic.org. That's skaldic.org. Thanks for listening to the History Extra podcast. This podcast was produced by Daniel Kramer Arden.